morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls. And if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and would like to bring those up here, you may call in and ask those questions, and we can discuss them in the coming half hour. Or if you have heard the program previously and you've heard this host give answers that you think are, you know, not quite right, and you'd like to bring balance, you'd like to correct them, you're welcome to do that. We're glad to have correction when that's called for. There's no reason to assume that the host has all the answers, and the purpose of the program is not to showcase the personal opinions of the host. Now, you might think otherwise because the personal opinions of the host do come out, but how could that not be? How could I answer a question without giving the way I look at it? But at the same time, our philosophy here is that the way I look at it is not the final word. And it's possible that the way I see it needs correction. So we welcome correction, and we welcome balance. So you need a phone number and a phone. That's the two things you need. Oh, and you need to have a question or something to say before you call in. And please, if you call in, please know what it is you're going to say, because sometimes people will call in, then once we put them on the line, they start thinking about what it is they called about and can't figure it out. If you've got a question about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your Christian walk, you can call. Or if you have, as I said, want to bring balance to something you've heard on the show, you can call about that. The number is, now here it comes, 1-800-227-5278. Now, we don't have any calls waiting, so you can get right through right now. 1-800-227-5278, and we await your calls. I want to say that on Saturday night, two nights ago, we had a gathering, which we do once a month, in Temecula. And I really apologize for those of you who are in Southern California and usually attend these meetings and didn't know about the meeting. We have all of our gatherings announced at our website. However, there was a mistake at the website that I did not fix quickly enough, and many people thought that there was no meeting this month, and that's a shame because we did have a great meeting. We had about half as many people as we usually do, in spite of the fact that the website indicated that there wouldn't be a meeting. Another thing is I didn't announce it. Usually all week before the meetings, I announce it here on the air. But because last week I was speaking in Colorado, I used what little time I have for announcements on the air to announce the Colorado meeting and neglected to mention the Temecula meeting. So my apologies to those of you in Southern California who normally come to those meetings and thought there wasn't one. That was my bad. And yet, if you are interested in coming to any of the meetings where I speak, I'd speak once a month in Santa Cruz, once a month in Temecula, usually once a month in Lake Forest, California, and once a month in Las Vegas. These are all Saturdays, and our website has those announcements. Once in a while, the website's wrong, but you can always email me to check. But it was unfortunately wrong much of the time this last few weeks, and therefore we confused, I think, some people who therefore did not show up who wanted to. I found out about the problem. One of the ways I found out is that somebody who usually comes emailed me and said, sorry, we're not going to be able to be there because you're not having the meeting this time. And I looked at the website and realized I had to change that. All right, well, enough banter. Our lines are filling up, and if you'd like to be on the program, you can get the number. You can dial this number, 1-800-227-5278. And by the way, the website that I've been mentioning is thenarrowpath.com. A lot of resources there. They're all free. And you'd be amazed how much is there that you can just take for free. Thenarrowpath.com. Frank from Rancho Cucamonga is first of all today. Hi, Frank. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Great.
My question regards speaking in tongues. One of my daughters was telling me she had gone to a prayer meeting recently, and it was a group of women. And they were all speaking in tongues, and they were kind of going around in this circle. And then when they got to her, they were, like, encouraging her to speak in tongues, and she wasn't familiar with this or anything. And she got kind of nervous and felt uncomfortable, so she just kind of, you know, just pretended is what she said. And she told me about it, and I'm familiar with, like, Acts chapter 2 and 1 Corinthians chapter 14, but my understanding is that speaking in tongues is something that the Spirit would lead you to do, and then when it's done, I believe there's supposed to be somebody else there that could interpret for this. So I was trying to explain that to her, but I don't know that I totally understand that either. It just didn't seem like it was necessarily biblical what they were doing, and she was uncomfortable right. about it and kind of voiced these concerns to me. So I don't know if you could add anything to that. Or
yeah, well, that's a shame that people would put her under pressure to speak in tongues. Obviously, you can't just speak in tongues because you want to. You must have the gift of tongues if you're going to do that. And you're right. In a public meeting, Paul indicated that a person who speaks in tongues should only do so if there's an interpreter present to interpret it. Now, a prayer meeting might be a little different than what Paul has in mind as a church meeting, because when Paul is discussing this in 1 Corinthians 14, he said, when the whole church comes together, you know, and he talks about there should only be two or three prophets, two or three speakers in tongues, and only with an interpreter. Paul is clearly, in 1 Corinthians 14, talking about the general meeting of the whole church. It's possible that in a smaller group that have just gathered to pray, you know, that some of the rules or some of the protocol might be a little different. It's a slightly different kind of meeting for a different purpose. But the same, nonetheless, I don't think that anyone should feel pressured to speak in tongues or to feel like they're an inferior Christian, because they don't. The Bible does not command that people speak in tongues, but it is the opinion of some, and particularly the Pentecostal denominations, that speaking in tongues is a necessary evidence of being filled with the Spirit. And the Bible actually doesn't say that anywhere. And therefore, I think it's a mistake for them to press that. Now, as far as what you're saying about tongues, there should be an interpreter. The Bible doesn't talk very much about speaking in tongues. You mentioned some of the main places that you do find it. Acts chapter 2, and you'll also, of course, find it in Acts chapter 10 and Acts chapter 19, but it's kind of the same thing in each case. When people are filled with the Spirit, in some cases, at least recorded, they spoke with tongues. Now, in those cases, they were speaking languages that the hearers understood. They were it was a sign to the unbelievers that a miracle had taken place, and the unbelievers themselves could understand the language. So you didn't even need an interpreter in a case like that, because the nature of the tongue was that you're speaking a language that the person to whom it's directed or for whose benefit is being done, they already know the language. It's their language. But Paul in 1 Corinthians 14 has a different use of tongues, apparently, in mind, because he talks about in the church. Now, to Paul, the church is not a gathering of unbelievers where you need to have signs for unbelievers. To Paul, the church is a gathering of Christians. It's he says everything should be done to edify the church, edify the body of Christ there. Paul's assuming that the majority, if not all, the people in the church meeting are Christians. Now, he does mention that, you know, it may be that one who's uninstructed or who's an unbeliever might show up, and you don't want to give them the impression everybody's crazy by having everyone speaking in tongues. But although he considers that an unbeliever might appear in the church, might show up, the church is primarily for believers, and Paul talks about how it's the person who can prophesy is doing a greater service for the church in edifying the church than the person who speaks in tongues, unless he interprets so that they can receive edification. So here we have an entirely different concept of tongues than we find in Acts. In Acts, there was no interpretation because the languages were the languages of the hearers. In Acts, the language, speaking in tongues was for the benefit of unbelievers as a sign to them. But in 1 Corinthians 14, it's for the benefit of the church. And it's not speaking in languages that anybody knows. It's speaking in languages that need to have a supernatural gift of interpretation to accompany them. And so those are two different things. Now, neither of those things were functioning, apparently, in the group your daughter went to?
Yeah, and she's a professing believer, and so are the other people that were at this prayer
right.
meeting, from my understanding.
But there was no interpretation there. Now,
no, not there at all. She just kind of made some stuff up, she said, and she felt very uncomfortable,
yeah.
and she was,
I understand.
It just didn't seem like a very good experience for her.
Yeah.
Now, I do
well,
have one
is
other
such
question.
A thing. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
In chapter 13, I noticed, and I'm not sure the verse because I don't have a Bible available to me right now, but it talks about different gifts, and I believe it talked about, and I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly or remembering it correctly, but it talked about prophecy and tongues passing away. What is meant by that? Does that mean that was only something for the early church that doesn't exist now, or am I misreading that, or...
Well, there are people who interpret it that way. You're thinking of 1 Corinthians 13:8, which says, love never fails, but whether there are prophecies, they will fail.
Yes,
whether there are
it.
Tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. I'm thinking that probably he has in mind there that when Jesus comes, there won't be need for these gifts anymore when the perfect one has come. Now, there's other ways this has been interpreted.
Is that talking about the second coming then?
Well, I think that would be the time that Paul has in mind, is when perfection has come. Now, there are other interpretations. Some people believe that when Paul talks about that which is perfect coming, that he's actually talking about the completion of the New Testament, which was still in the process of being written when Paul wrote this. But I don't see really any contextual or exegetical reason for saying that Paul is thinking of the canon of the New Testament. You know, neither Paul nor his audience probably even knew there would be a canon of the New Testament at this point in time. Paul was writing none of the Gospels were written yet when Paul wrote this, and most of the epistles. So it seems that, you know, at the time Paul was writing this, there might have been five books of the New Testament written of the 27. So I don't really think that Paul had in mind, or his readers, you know, the New Testament canon. I think he has something more absolute in mind than that. And I think he probably has the second coming of Christ in mind as the time when things will pass away. And one reason I think so, too, is because earlier in the same epistle, in 1 Corinthians 1:7, Paul told the church that they come behind in no gift awaiting the revelation of Jesus Christ. And if we take the revelation of Jesus Christ to mean the second coming, and that is how I understand it, then he says that they will lack in no gift while they're waiting for that, you know, the second coming of Christ. So that would be my take on that.
Okay, well, that's very helpful. I really appreciate that, Steve.
Okay, Frank, good talking to you, brother.
Thank you very much. God bless, brother.
I appreciate your call. Okay, let's talk to Jay from Redlands, California. Excuse me. Jay, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey,
thanks
Steve,
for calling.
How's it going?
All right.
Hey, I had a question. I went through some like stuff in my life. My girlfriend passed away, and I got this guy attacked me with a knife, and I was like, I don't know. Anyways, though, I take like anti-anxiety medicine and stuff, but that stuff doesn't work for me. And then recently, I became a medical marijuana patient, and that stuff seems to help me, but I was just wondering if God would be against marijuana. It helps me with anxiety, though, and digesting food and stuff like that. But I was just wondering if God would be against that, though.
Well, you know, there's a strange phenomenon in our time, even among Christians, that pot is stigmatized in a way that other medications are not. I mean, I realize that pot is something that people typically use recreationally, and I believe that Christians should not be favorable toward the idea of the use of consciousness-altering substances for recreational purposes. Nonetheless, Christians usually have no problem with the doctor prescribing morphine or something else that changes your mood or whatever. I mean, in other words, there are consciousness-altering substances which Christians have no problem with morally if the doctor has prescribed them. But for some reason, if the doctor prescribes pot, some Christians think that's a problem. Now, I don't really see that weed is... Now, by the way, I'll just say this. I've never smoked weed. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen my picture. I look like a hippie, and I'm from the 70s, but I never did smoke weed. I was a Christian from my childhood, and I was in the ministry when I was in my teens. I've never actually even... taken a puff, and I certainly didn't inhale. But the truth is that I'm not so alarmed by marijuana as some people are. I don't think Christians should use marijuana or any other consciousness-altering substance recreationally. But if a doctor prescribes it, if it's doing the same thing that some other kind of pharmaceutical drug could do, I don't really see in principle what there would be that either God or Christians should oppose it. Now, I think the main problem that people have with it who are against medical marijuana is that they realize that a lot of people are going to get prescriptions for marijuana who don't really have a medical condition at all. You know, there are these medical marijuana dispensaries that will give out marijuana for, very minor. There's doctors who will just give a prescription to anyone who wants one for it, so that it really is a way of legalizing recreational use of marijuana for many people. On the other hand, I have known at least a couple of Christian friends, very dedicated Christians, who are seriously minded, holy people, who have chronic pain. And because of their chronic pain, they are using medical marijuana, and it has helped them in some way. So, again, I, as one who's never, I've never used marijuana. Most of my friends, of course, did. In fact, in the 70s, I was probably the only person I knew who hadn't used it. So I know there's a lot of listeners out there who have a lot more inside knowledge of what it really does to you to use marijuana than I would have. And it's possible that some would say, and because they know more than I do about it, that, marijuana is dangerous in ways that other meds are not. I'm not aware of it. If it is so, then that should be taken into consideration. But if it's just something that the doctor is giving you instead of some kind of anti-anxiety medication, then, I would say this. I don't think Christians really ultimately should need anti-anxiety medications, and I don't think they should need marijuana for that purpose either. I believe that anxiety is a spiritual condition. Now, I realize all our psychiatrically oriented people out there are just going to roll over in their, not in their graves because they're alive. They're going to be upset. They're going to tear their hair out because I just said it's a spiritual condition. Well, all I know is that the Bible treats it as a spiritual condition, and I've known many people who were using some kind of medication, prescribed medication for anxiety, and they decided against using it, and they stopped using it, and instead they got close to God and actually lived and thought in biblical patterns, and lots of people I know have never needed the meds since. So I personally am of the opinion that anxiety is a spiritual condition, not a physical condition. And if it's not physical, it really ultimately should not require medications of any kind, I think. But if a person is taking medications for anything, I don't know why marijuana would be frowned upon more than some other pharmaceutical remedy to a condition. But again, that's a separate issue than whether I think anxiety should be treated with marijuana or with some other drug. These are nuanced issues. Some people make everything black and white about these things. You know, say, oh, marijuana's bad. Well, marijuana can be, I suppose, used for a good purpose, but not everyone who's using it is using it for a purpose that I would think is recommendable.
Well, thanks, brother. Thanks so much for answering that. Do you think, like, too, though, that it has to do with, like, because my Christian brother, he always tells me that, that's not right, and I'm like, well, what about the first page of the Bible? It says, like, every green tree on earth is, for us, and, God put it on earth for us, something along those lines.
God did make every herb of the field for man to eat for food, the Bible says. I don't know that marijuana is very nutritious, and, maybe Yul Gibbons could eat tree bark and find it nutritious, but most of us find there are a lot of plants that aren't really useful for food. For example, poison oak. I don't think we'd probably see that as something suitable for food. So there are foods, there are plants that God made that he did not make for us to ingest. On the other hand, there are plants that God made that I believe are, they have herbal, medicinal qualities. And whether he made marijuana with that in mind, I do not know. But I would say that smoking marijuana recreationally cannot be justified by the statement that God made every herb of the field for man, because I don't know of anyone who eats marijuana just for nutrition.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, brother, for answering all my questions.
Right,
thank you. Have a good day.
Good talking to you.
God bless you.
You too. You too. Bye now. Okay, our next call is David from Beaumont, California. Hi, David. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. My question was, I had a two-part question, actually. Did you already speak on the Kingdom of God in Colorado?
I did that last week, yes.
Is that recorded and available for us to record or buy or purchase something?
Well, they recorded it, or they tried to. The first night, there was two nights, and the first night they only got half of it recorded because of some malfunction. The second night they recorded and videotaped it, and I have a feeling that that's going to be something you can watch online eventually. I don't have the recordings, but I think they're going to let me know, and then I can let you know. But if you're interested in the teaching on the Kingdom of God, I condensed into two lectures what I normally would take much more time to teach, and the longer version of the same teaching is in eight lectures, and it is posted at our website, the older, the longer version.
All right. The reason I was interested is I have a ministry. I love ministering to Jehovah's Witnesses, and they have two main points, their premier doctrines that they usually they boast of or they're proud of or they usually focus on. One is the name of God, Yahweh or Jehovah in English, and that's their claim to fame, sort of. Their second point that they usually focus on highly is their gospel. And the gospel that they preach, they boast that their gospel is different than, they boast that it's another gospel, that it's a different gospel other than the one that Christians have preached for the past 2,000 years. And it's focused primarily on Matthew 24, where it talks about wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and many false prophets shall come. You shall be hated by all nations. They claim that they are the ones that are hated by all nations. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world, and then the end shall come. And so I'm interested in your lectures because, number one, you're correct that most Christians aren't familiar with that portion of the gospel. Could you speak on that, please?
Yeah. In one respect, the Jehovah's Witnesses may have something when they say that the gospel of the kingdom has not been preached steadily, consistently throughout the church age. I believe that the gospel of the kingdom was preached by the apostles, and I think it is preached by many Christians today. I don't think the Jehovah's Witnesses are preaching the gospel of the kingdom. But despite the fact that there are some Christians who do preach the gospel of the kingdom, there are other Christians who preach a watered-down, altered version of the gospel, I think. And so we do need to look at the gospel as Jesus preached it and the apostles preached it. And we will sometimes find that it is different than the way that some 20th and 21st century evangelicals in America have preached it. there's a variety of gospels that are preached in our modern time, and not all of them are consistent with the biblical gospel of the kingdom. But the Jehovah's Witnesses are not the ones who have gotten it right. It's interesting that the gentleman who invited me to come to speak in Colorado is a former Jehovah's Witness himself. He's been a Christian for many, many years, but he was converted out of the Jehovah's Witnesses. But anyway, if you go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, the lectures there are, of course, free to download. And there's if you go to the topical lectures link, topical lectures, you'll find a series there on the Kingdom of God. And that'd be the more thorough version of what I taught.
I'm going to do that. I've actually already downloaded them, and I have them burnt on a CD. I just haven't popped them into my CD player. But now that I've talked to you, I was hoping to get your latest recordings, but I guess part one is not going to be available. But I look forward to the videotape, and I will listen to your lectures, the eight part that you have on your website. So I appreciate that very much.
Great talking to you, David.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Pat, calling from El Cajon, California. Hi, Pat. Welcome.
Good morning, sir. I have been a little bit interested because it seems like it's only recorded in Matthew 27, and it talks about the graves open and many bodies of the saints who were fallen asleep were raised.
Yes.
And came out of the... What happened to those people?
Well, it looks to me like they probably were persons a lot like Lazarus or Jairus' daughter who had died in the recent past and who came to life when Jesus came to life and probably lived out their lives and maybe died again. Now, some people think that instead of that, they ascended when Jesus did, but we have no record of that unless it is mentioned in Ephesians 4, where it says, when he ascended, he led a host of captives. Some people think that maybe when Jesus ascended, he took with him people like that, who had been in captivity of Hades before, and they now ascended into heaven with him. That would be a theory that might have some merit, but as I understand it, see, some people, when they read these verses, it's verse 51, behold, the veil of the temple is torn. It says, and the graves were opened, verse 52. Many of the bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. It sounds like it's saying that godly people who were recognized by living people in Jerusalem came out of their graves when Jesus did and were seen in Jerusalem. Now, we might have the impression this is referring to old saints from the Old Testament, like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob or Moses. But it doesn't seem likely that that's who it's talking about, because they wouldn't be recognized. Nobody living had ever seen them, and no one would recognize them from, you know, from their looks. So it seems to me probable that these were godly people, you know, of the godly remnant, who had died recently, like Lazarus had, and came back to life, and their resurrection at the time of Christ's resurrection was a testimony to the people in Jerusalem that something amazing had happened. And that amazing thing was that the Messiah had arisen from the dead. I don't know more than that, because you're right, Matthew's the only gospel that mentions it, and he doesn't give any more information than the little bit we just mentioned. So we have to use our imaginations a little bit to figure out what really went on. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have this program each weekday for a half hour. We are listener-supported, and we do pay for the radio time. And if we keep paying for the time, we stay on the air. If we don't, then we don't. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you might want to visit our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. You can find out there how you might donate. Please tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless.